Welcome to Grief Is My Side Hustle. I am beyond delighted today. I love my job. I love that I get to do this. I have David Ferruccio from Dead Talks on with us today. David, thank you so much for being
thank
here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. You're a lovely human to be next to digitally or in person.
Look, you are in a studio that I have been in because when I had a big book party in LA, that was the first time we met, and our meet cute is one of my favorites. You did not know me. You were sitting very peaceably looking something up on your phone, and I looked at you and was like, David, you're here. Oh my God. And you were like, I'm here. Oh my God. And then 2 seconds later, I was like, so you should have me on your podcast. So I came in hot the first time we met. And I just really appreciate that you were able to roll with that and did not run away screaming. Who is that lady in all of her intensity?
Yeah, no, I'm all about that. I think you came with a specific energy that honestly, in that moment, I was so dialed out of that moment, which is not a great thing to be not present in the moment. But I love the way you came at everything with so much positive energy, and it was cool to make it happen the next day.
You let me come into your home and onto your podcast, and we talked about my book and my experience with grief and loss. I can't wait to turn the tables today and ask you about your experience and what brings you into your podcasting work and all of your work in the world of grief and loss in general. So I'm just going to start with the question I ask all my guests, which is what brings you into the world of grief and loss?
Yeah, so thank you. What brings me into the world of grief and loss was grief and loss. I lost my father on September 11th when I was 12 years old, and that was a big checkpoint in my life. And it's been a part of my life ever since in many different ways. It's evolved for me. And I'm sure you're going to tap into some specific questions that you want me to go through. But it's carried me through this part of my life where now I have a podcast talking about other people's grief and loss. And I couldn't be happier in a sense that I feel like such a terrible event, even though terrible sometimes isn't just the easy word to use. But to me, it's just life, as cliche and off-putting that may sound, but grief and loss is a big part of my life now, and it's brought me to here to talk to you, and I'm excited about it.
Can you tell us the constellation of your family? Who makes up your family? Who lived through this experience with you?
Yeah, so right now it was my mom and is my mom and my two older sisters, Jacqueline and Gina. They're 7 years and five and a half years older than me, so a bit of a gap difference, which is a bigger gap difference at that time of our life. Now there's way more similarities, but I think me being 12, Gina being around 17, Jacqueline 18, it's a it's a different dynamic of processing. I think when it comes to processing anything, especially losing someone in your life, there's just so many layers. It's like, there's so many dynamics. I think when people on the surface look at grief or just loss in general, it's, oh, they lost that person and the bus stops there. Obviously, I don't think people think that entirely, but there's just so many layers of my sister Gina just getting to college. She's 17. Jacqueline being home alone at 18, me being 12, and my mom. It's just, there's so many layers and different individual perspectives that affect the way we all process it. And so at the time, yes, and at the time now, it's my sister and my sisters and my mom, but we have so much support, where even that day when I came home, my cousins, family, friends were all there that day. So immediately it was my mom, my sisters, but there was a ripple cascading effect of family and friends all coming together.
So you had a lot of support, it sounds like, that your memory of being young and maybe on the younger side of the cohort of your people that were around, your memory is that there were a lot of people there for you.
Absolutely. And then that's why I feel I had a lot of advantages to go through what I went through. A lot with this podcast and a lot of my introspection throughout the years tends to look at the other side of the coin. I think that's just in my nature, for better or for worse, taking the devil's advocate and seeing what other people have gone through. And I, for whatever reason, have that support. And I know it's easier, or whatever the word is. I've had that in my life, and I can't be more thankful, because I don't know what it would have been like without. And there's so many people that don't have that big wide net of support catching them when they fall. And even with that net, you still have to go through things. So it's not like it just takes away all the pain and everything you're going through. But I'm very aware that I have a tremendous mother that wanted to carry the burden of the cross. My sister's supporting me, my family, my friends, even to this day, when I need someone to lean on or be there when I don't ask, I have that. And so I have a hard time comprehending how people get through things without that support.
One thing I wanted to ask you about, because it always runs through my mind, is it's really a unique experience to be someone who is directly affected by something that everyone thinks they were affected by, that everybody was affected by, right? Like there are public events that are very personal and specific to people and families. You can talk about this from a kid experience, or you can talk about it even from now. Are there elements of that are either good or bad? The fact that your personal loss was part of this big collective grief experience for the globe. Does that make it better, worse? Does it feel like people say, oh, it was bad for all of us, but really that's not the same as losing a dad? I've always wondered about this.
Yeah, I think about that. And again, a lot of my processes happen later in life. I think growing up, becoming who I am today and really understanding a lot of it more. I think then when I was 12 years old, I didn't really contemplate that because this is such a weird experience. And my dad was gone. I didn't really contemplate, oh, the whole world's affected by this. It just felt, even though the whole world was affected with it, to me, it was just our family. I don't know if that comes out selfish or just ignorant at the age of 12.
No.
It wasn't completely unaware because obviously it was, I saw on the TV and everyone knew about it. But I think as I got older and think about it today, it's interesting. And I think that is a big part of why I have my podcast, because a lot of it was reciprocated on the fact that I lost my dad in the public light. And it was a global event that everyone knows. So a big part of what I'm doing now is wanting to share other stories, because I am aware that it happened with the world. And granted, it's not just my dad, it's thousands of other people that were there that day. But there's a comfort, and also it's good and bad. I think my sister said it when I had her on my podcast, something about it was a little overwhelming not having that time alone to do it, because everyone with great intention is like all around you and it's constantly being talked about. So it's constantly in your face. So I think that might be the negative aspect, but the positive aspect is, again, the support that we had. And I think as a nation, the one positive from events like this historically is like there is that coming together. So there is that event that brings people together. And as weird as that sounds, it was a positive from it, but it definitely is weird to have it happen in such a public light and it's not hidden at all.
Yeah. I love that you just mentioned that your sister was on the podcast, because I've said this to you before, that your episode with your family, particularly the episode with your mom, is just so moving to me, for you guys to be reflecting as adults what everybody's experience and intention was way back then. When there's a tragedy and a sudden loss, everybody's just doing the best they can. And I think there's this of, particular maybe with siblings, like they lost their dad, but the reality is actually each individual child, like you lost your dad and your sister lost her dad and your other sister lost her dad. He's the same person, but the relationships are slightly different. Mm-hmm. And there was just something about listening to your mom and her reflecting on what she saw in you at that time, and you reflecting what you felt from her in that time, it's just really beautiful. What made you want to interview them? How do you pick who you bring on your show? And how did you decide that you wanted to talk openly and in public about those early moments and days?
One thing I'm learning in regards to my process with this podcast, I feel in the beginning it's the beginning and the middle and where I'm at now. I learned to go back to just sharing stories or talking to who I want to talk to, as opposed to just going in it with, oh, I think my audience wants to hear this. Of course, I want to be cognizant of what my audience wants and try to give them what they want. But at the same time, I'm doing this from what I find interesting and what I want to share. And selfishly, with talking with my family, I looked at it as an opportunity where I thought, I think this would be good for them. And they'll tell me if they don't want to do it, then that's fine. But also blended with, I'm going to learn a lot from talking to my sisters and my mom. We're very close. We talk about a lot of things, but it's different when you hone in for an hour forcibly talking about something. It's different than just sitting at the kitchen table sometimes. And yeah. So for me, I wanted to dig into a different perspective, truly hear my sisters out, truly understand what my mom went through, because I feel like as a mother and as a natural protector that she is, she hid a lot of stuff from us that she didn't want to see, want to show us at the time, especially to show strength and keep us going. And so again, it was me wanting to learn more about my mom, me wanting to learn more about my sisters. And as an effect from that, I feel like other people can relate, because I think such a big part of this grief aspect is our relationships with the people around us during grief. That's such a big aspect of how we process things differently, because our relationships, like you said, even with the people that are alive, affect how we process things. And we might not be agreeable about how our sister or brother or mother handle things. You can get frustrated at them. So I think by talking and understanding each other, you see a different side that may allow you to understand a little deeper. It's as simple as that. So long answer long is I just wanted to talk to my sisters and mom, and I know how amazing they are. I know how strong they are. And I just feel like their perspectives and their voices could help someone else.
I certainly have that experience. You have great guests on your podcast, and you have a big podcast, and you get people who we may have seen in our Instagram feed or on TikTok, or your guests are already sometimes speaking in their platforms, but then you ask them your curious questions, which I love. You have a really curious way of interviewing people and engaging with them. And it looks to me like learning with them or from them. But the ones with your mother and your sister are just, they're really, I related to them because I interviewed my kids on my podcast. I wanted to hear from them. And it's different talking about it than it is talking about it with the idea of an audience. People just sometimes, I think, offer a little bit more, a little bit differently.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially with my mom. She was definitely thinking about it too much. So we got to New York City from Jersey a little early, and we went to the bar before, like, I think the bar opened at like 10 a.m. We got there at like 9:54 and they let us in. So I had to loosen my mom up a little bit.
So good.
I think we were like at a little bit of a buzz in us. And then all of a sudden, as soon as we hit record, she was my mom. And that's exactly what I wanted the world to see. Yeah. The world, like, everyone's watching, but I wanted people to see, because she was her on the podcast. And sometimes when you put a mic in front of someone, even though you said more comes out, sometimes it's you feel the cameras on you.
Totally.
I think everyone got a taste for who my mom and my sisters are authentically. And that's the beauty of it. Because without my sisters and my mom, I don't even know.
So how old were your parents when your dad died? How old was your dad? How old was your mom?
My dad was 46. So my mom at the time, June, September, she might have just turned 45.
I always like to ask that, particularly when we're talking about something historical, because I'm turning 50. So I'm older than both of your parents were in that moment. I have a 14-year-old and an 11-year-old right now. And again, listening to your mom talk about what her intentions were and how important it was for her to care for you all just reminds us that there's no such thing as actually being an adult. We're just like people going through things. There's no such thing as that fantasy of the person who knows how to handle or how to go through or how to survive. Mm. And one thing that I think is clear in those conversations is that we need each other. We need children. We need cousins. We need people around us to care about what we're going through, and also for us to care about them, because part of what you talk about is it was important for you to also want to take care of your mom back. Or at least that's what she seemed to think you were trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're just humans having human experience, and we don't know. I don't know. We have our beliefs. We think we're here for X, Y, Z. We think what's going to happen after, but
yeah.
Me, I have no idea. I have my thoughts about what this is all about, but I have no idea. And this is where we are. And at the end of the day, I think we're all here to learn, whatever that means. And we're all just doing the best we can. And yeah. If we're not doing the best we can, most people know we're not doing the best we can. And you know, we have that little voice in our head, but
yeah.
we're all figuring it out, whatever the heck it may be.
So where was the trajectory? You're 12. And then how does life go for you? There's this catastrophic, terrible event, which you talk about almost from a strength perspective of really having gratitude for all the people that were there for you. But I imagine some of that is a historical look back, that in those moments and days, that would have been an incredibly crazy, hard thing to integrate and figure out how to be. But how do we get from there to here?
Ooh, that's a big question. A lot of it for me, what I've said multiple times is when I was younger, there's so much I forget. And
yeah,
a lot of the processing for me, again, was as I got older, as I was more cognitive, I had to sit back and think about who I am today and not having a father at such a young age, my family, what actually happened, the wildness that was 9/11, and just to think that happened. So as a kid, it's hard for me to even contemplate. The only thing I do remember is I remember as I was a young teenager, and I never know if it was just because being a young teenager or there were things coming at him. Me and my mom definitely were combative. Like, I think I was just a pain in the ass because I know it wasn't my mom looking back at it. Like, my mom was doing everything. And I think I was a little bit of a pain in the ass. I would get frustrated. And I feel like there was a weird aggression in me. Like, I didn't really get in trouble. I got in trouble in third grade, but that's way before my dad died. It's a whole other conversation. I feel like there was a level of frustration in me that I still don't know if I tie it to that or if it's me being a young teen, this and that. Like, I don't know, but there was definitely, I remember me and my mom used to bang heads, and again, because of me. And I don't know if that came out because of what happened. I don't have an answer for that, but I feel like that was just me growing up and getting through it and whatnot. I was just going through the motions of life. I don't know if I process things like I do now, because my mom would always try to get me to talk and give me that opportunity. She didn't force me. She didn't say, I have to do this or that. But my sister's reminded me of, and I don't even remember this. That's the messed up part and the frustrating part about being a man today. There's so much I don't remember.
Yeah.
I need to find some other modalities that I know are out there to progress back and see what can come up. That's something that I'm looking forward to trying. Mm-hmm. But my mom and my sisters, we used to do this thing at the table. Apparently we used to have these dinners and we would talk. And my sisters and my mom would always tell me after I spoke to them, I would just sit there and listen and absorb it all, but wouldn't say much. Huh. And so my thought now is when I see programs out there that have kids trying to express more, I think that's so important. I think that's something that would have helped me more, is learning to express more and learning to tell, really get it out with people that I trust, or find a community if you don't have people that you trust. And I feel like that's something I wasn't doing good enough at the time, was getting it out. My mom, again, would always say I kept things in, and now look at me having a podcast talking about it. I think that was part of my process of figuring out how to express, how to get the shit out of me.
Yeah.
And then again, today, as I got older, it's a totally different mindset of how I see things because of what I went through, or what we went through.
Do you have friends, kids from then that are still friends now?
Yeah, a lot. A lot. Yeah. That's great. I actually saw a buddy in the city when I was there, what the heck was it there, on Christmas. And he left a big imprint on me. Grew up very close, same baseball teams, close to the family. We just, through life, we haven't stayed in touch as much and occasionally say hi. But I saw him and I said, Jay, if you're listening, I was like, yo, you know what? I just randomly thought, I remember when we had the memorial for my father at St. Leo's Church, that same year, whenever it happened. And a lot of my friends from middle school were there that showed up. And I was so impacted. And that's the one thing, little moments I do remember. I remember seeing JJ walk out and he was crying. And it was so bizarre to me to see a friend of mine cry for my father and the memorial that we had. And that always stuck with me. I don't know what it was, but I think it's reciprocal, the support that I had and my friends and my family. But to see the impact that my father had, or maybe just the emotions of the entire thing, I don't know, had on my friend that I would never have thought would get super sad about something that didn't happen to them. That moment, I still see it in my head, was very impactful. And I think that kind of comes all together about the camaraderie that humans should have or can have that just changed everything. That wasn't even internal. That was external, looking at the way my friend reacted to my loss. And it was just so, I don't know, it was just a beautiful moment, not because he was sad, but just seeing the impact that we all have amongst each other and how important it is, like you said, to come together and to show that compassion and to be there for each other, as corny as that sounds.
It doesn't sound corny at all. And I think it makes a good argument, actually. People often ask me, should I bring a kid? My kid is only however old. Should I bring them to a funeral of someone that maybe we're adjacent? It's not their uncle. It's their best friend's uncle. And first of all, the answer to that is I have no idea. I have no idea what anyone should do, really. All I can say is if you're asking the question, there's probably some wisdom in wondering whether or not it would be good for you. And I imagine for JJ, it was good for him to feel that kind of empathy and maybe love and connection. And certainly it was really impactful for you.
Yeah.
Because like, we're narcissistic at that age. We're not really thinking about what other people are thinking about. And maybe that's part of what helps. You're not wondering whether the whole world is sad about 9/11. It's like you and your family, and you're focused on that.
Yeah,
but knowing that the people who are close to you do care, you could see it right on his face.
Yeah, that's the wild part. Looking at it like that is just, I don't know, we think we live in this in our own bubble, which often I may be in this bubble. There's another bubble around it. There's another bubble around that is a cascading effect of one event to the other, and how it may be personal to us or personal to you, but it affects the people around you so much. I think that was our early lesson for me, to show the ripple effect of these events that we all go through in life and how much it affects the people around us, not just you, in ways that you may never see. So I think to see that at 12 years old was something that always stuck with me and made me realize the actions that I take, the decisions that I make, the way I respond to certain things have a ripple effect and affect the people around you, and to be cognitive of that.
What about how people react when they hear that your dad died in 9/11? Even now, is that a, do you get like a gasp? Do you get a, oh my God, how I, there are certain things in my life where I am hesitant to say them because I'm like, oh, I know what the standard reaction is. And I don't want to play that part for you right now. Or I don't want to be your curiosity monkey, or I don't want to. So how did you learn to navigate that? How do you navigate it now?
Well, excuse my French, but I have a fucked up sense of humor. So I lean into that way too much now because I notice the reactions I get. And I think maybe at first I was more sensitive to it. But now I lead with humor so much that most people, it takes a second to realize. I don't know, just like randomly say, hey, my name's Dave Ferrugia, my dad died in 9/11. But it comes up contextually where, and I get that, and I get a kick out of the reaction, because my big thing is I get the reactions of most people, especially on the West Coast, don't rarely meet people that were directly affected. Back East is different. Like that's, they know someone.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
But when I meet someone, it's, you're like the first person I knew that was directly affected. I'm like, yeah, welcome to my world. And I usually, if I drop the line, I usually throw in their faces to get that reaction or expect that reaction. And then I try to crack a joke that is usually very dark to diffuse it. And I think that's a big mechanism for me in general of coping with things, is I like to laugh at things. And it can easily be seen as a deflection, but to me it's, I just gotta laugh at this shit, 9/11, but like life in general, because this is, it's sometimes it's comical to me because we all have no idea in so many capacities. I heard something on a podcast recently, like you could be certified, this is supposed to be a really good way to say this, and I'm forgetting, certified or experienced, like you can be certified at something, like you're certified and you're experienced at it, you know what I mean? Like you're certified but have the street cred for talking about grief.
Yeah.
And as much as I talk about these things, acting like I know, I have no idea. And I think getting those reactions out of people and diffusing it immediately for me with humor lets their guard down. And then they're able to talk about it more. Cause if they show that, if I show I'm okay with it, quote unquote, then it relaxes everyone. And they may be able to ask questions that they would want to ask, but feel like they're being rude. But to me, when I get that, yes, those gasps or like those holy shits, and they see that either I'm mentally disturbed or they see that I'm okay with it, they're just, it opens the door for them. And it's like a signal call. Yo, if you want to ask me a question, I'll talk about it. Not that, but I have a podcast, I talk about it, so I better be okay. But again, humor to me diffuses situations and it opens the door maybe for someone else to dig in a little bit more if you show that you're willing.
You just described something really perfectly that I didn't exactly know how to put my finger on. But you do this thing where you're like out on the street and you ask strangers about their experiences with loss. Mm-hmm. Which is pretty bold, right? Like you walk up to them with a big microphone and you just ask. And what's totally stunning is people answer you, and they don't answer you. They don't. So here's a subject that what we're saying is nobody ever wants to talk about it, except you walk up to strangers in the street. Like I'm assuming you're down at the pier or something. And you're like, you just ask a flat out question and then they answer you. Mm-hmm. You talk to people who are old, young, men, women, everybody. And their answers almost always choke me up. They are telling you something that they are carrying with them that's invisible, and you can see that they appreciate being asked about it. And I have always thought, I had a professor who was really direct, and he would say things like, your paper was shitty. And as he handed it back, and I teach, and I would be like, God, I could never, even if their paper was shitty, I would never say that to someone. That's not my way. There is something about the way that you are just like, hey, I want to know, and I'm going to ask.
Yeah.
That is so inviting to other people. They do not shy away from you. I'm sure there's some outtakes where people are like, who are you, lunatic? Walk away. But for the most part, it is so compelling to watch you do that. When did that start? How did you decide to do it? How do you pick who you're going to talk to? How did that all come about?
Yeah, I see these street interviews all the time. And I think part of it was me making fun of in my head how stupid the questions were. And yeah. I'm not judging, but I am. I'm talking about questions like, how many people did you sleep with? In my head, I'm like, I don't like,
totally.
This is stupid to me. Again, do what you got to do. If you're making money, whatever. But it just related to wanting to ask real questions. And there's plenty of people doing that. I haven't seen too many people talk about death on the street. Like, I don't know who else is doing that. Not that it matters, but it was just more asking hard questions and doing it in a way that's hopefully approachable. And then I'm not here to judge you. And people understand why I'm doing it if I explain it clearly. But I think just wanting to talk to more people, being more accessible and doing it in these quick ways is just interesting. And what's more interesting than talking to people on the spot that aren't prepared for it? I think you just get way more honest answers. So it was a way of just showing that how common it is, how everyone has an opinion on it, everyone has experience with it. It was just another way to talk to more people randomly. And that was literally it. And I thought, what better than to do it on the street and see if this would actually work? So I had to do it for the first time, not sure how it would work. And I was pleasantly surprised at how many people were willing to talk to me and how many people want to talk about it. Because I think most people aren't getting asked these questions. Most people shy away from it because a lot of people don't want to ask those questions. They want to be polite. They want to be sensitive towards people and do this. But I feel like coming at it from a stranger, I think maybe people are more willing to talk because I'm coming unbiased and I'm not coming with these assumptions prior to asking. It's just two people chopping it up. Tell me what's up. And then that's it. It's been so much fun. And I've done it in several different cities and areas and something that I really want to continue doing.
I really encourage people to go find it because it's really powerful. But I also think it's because you're not afraid of it. That's what it feels like to me. When you were just talking a minute ago about, I enjoy freaking people out and watching their reaction and being like, hey, let me tell you about my life. I have five brothers and sisters and people have very strong reactions to that. And I always would be like, I'm teeing it up. You think I'm an only child, but I'm about to tell you. And I like people's reactions to it. And then I like their questions about it. And so I can embrace that part of my story. Yours is this deep tragedy that people immediately can insert themselves in, or maybe they want to tell you where they were when 9/11 happened, because that is, it's a shared experience by everybody. But what I'm really struck by when you're doing this is that you do not seem afraid of people's stories. You seem to care about them, but I'm not worried you're going to go home and start drinking because you asked that guy and he told you a very hard, sad story. Like, to me, it feels like you walked up to him with your own, having walked your own hard path, and you want to hear the story. And then they tell you.
Yeah. You know, not thinking about it, I feel like a lot of it has to do with, again, the fact that my dad died on September 11th, not only was, and again, this is no hierarchy of who lost who, there's been plenty of quote unquote worse things that have happened, but the fact that it happened in the way it did. And to me, again, individually at such a young age, it really just showed me how quickly things can happen. Very young in my life, it showed me how quickly things can change, unexpected, for the better or for worse. This shit just happens. And so I think that kind of not numb me, but it just made me realize, oh, this happens. This can happen to you. And this does happen to other people. And it's made me more aware and less afraid of being shocked that something happened to someone. Because to me, I'm like, anything can happen. I don't care how ridiculous, anything can happen. Like the day, when my buddy told me when he came late to school, he's like, doesn't your dad work in the towers? And yes, there's like a plane flew into the building. I'm like, a fucking plane? What are you, Jeff, did you smoke again before school? Because that makes no sense. And so just that how absurd it was, how absurd it still is, and how absurd so many other things happen. It just taught me at a young age that anything can happen. So I think maybe correlating it to what you're saying, when I hear other people's stories, it doesn't come, I'm not completely numb to it. Like it's still, oh my God, that's wild that happened. But it's also not shocking because I'm expecting the unexpected. And I think that's what has been a big lesson in my life, is expecting the unexpected, because it can happen, and not in a depressing way. Just like I have two eyes in the back of my head and being like, this can happen. And also living life without expecting it is a balancing act. Cause I feel like when something tragic happens, you can easily either two ways. You can just try to be aware of it, like I think I'm expressing, or also be worried that anything can happen. There's two doors to that room where it's, I could be constantly worried that shit can happen at any moment. I could be constantly worried that something horrible is going to happen, or I can choose the avenue of being like, okay, this happened. I know it can happen again, but I'm going to be more grateful and live my life in a certain way that, yes, it can be removed and taken from me in every moment, but that's just going to make me appreciate what I have now, as opposed to constantly being worried about, oh my God, if I drive this way, if I go that way, something might happen.
Well, the thing about constant worry is it doesn't actually do anything. It doesn't prevent the bad things from happening.
No, so not at all.
You can constantly worry about it or not constantly worry about it. Still, the random ass tragedies that break our lives wide open, whether you worry about that or not, it doesn't control that or stop that from happening.
No, that's a choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the other thing that I was thinking, to me.
The other thing I was thinking about, and we talked a little bit about this on when I was with you, when you interviewed me, is I think when you're 12 and you suddenly have that understanding, there can be terror and deficit and misery about that. Or there can be a little bit of freedom. I was 9 when this teenager in my life drowned. And I distinctly remember going to school. And I wrote about this in my book. And like this kid talking about like a dog in a book and how sad it was that this dog, this old dog had died. And I remember, I almost remember myself as like an old man with a cigar where I'm like, kid, you don't know anything. Like teenagers can die. Like, there was this bad element to that, but also like a freedom in it, a freedom and understanding that terrible things happen and then we survive those terrible things somehow. People, and in that story, I was adjacent to that. I was not part of the primary family that lost this teenager, but I saw the fallout for many. And I do think there is that concept of traumatic growth, like something good that can grow out of the trauma. What you have described is there was a lot of good that showed up right even in the moment of the trauma. And I've heard you say you love your life. So you're not looking back and saying, oh my gosh, everything about my life is negative and bad on account of this terrible tragedy that happened. Does that sound right?
Yeah, no, that sounds right. And I feel like, I guess it is freeing in some capacity, but to me, the biggest freedom is probably ignorance, because then I see people that haven't experienced some things and then they live life like it can't happen because you're just literally oblivious to it. So part of me is, I think that's true freedom, because you have no idea.
Yeah.
But then it's like until it smacks you in the face, then I don't know how you're going to handle it. But I don't know. I think it's all just a balancing act. I have no idea.
I get jealous of people who, I had several miscarriages, and I remember being very jealous of people who were just like blissfully pregnant, not constantly anxious that something bad could happen in their pregnancy. I wanted to ask you about the guests that you have had on, and if any have really stuck in your mind, people that you have learned something from or reacted to, not loved what they were saying. I'm just curious if, because you've been doing this a minute and you have a bunch of folks that you've spoken to. Has anything really landed when I ask that question? Is there somebody that pops up and you think, God, I love that interview? Or even, I hated that interview.
Our episode, I absolutely hate it. No, I'm just kidding.
That Megan lady was a pain in the ass.
Now, it's a tough question to answer on the spot, because I'd want to do honor to all the episodes I have. I have 140 something episodes. There's overarching narratives and a specific lesson that, again, seems pretty obvious, but I feel like it's a consistency in what I'm hearing in a lot of people that have gotten through. One, outside of naming a specific episode, it was just allowing yourself to feel. And I think people understand this as a mechanistic approach, but I don't know if people allow themselves to do it enough, is truly allow yourselves to feel it. And naming a specific episode, there's a guy named Sadi Simone that I had on. He has an approach that talks about, because I said something about feeling my emotions and then understanding them and really digressing with them. And he takes an approach of allow yourself to feel the emotion, which is just a sensation, which is just a feeling. don't attach a story to it. Don't try, just try not to say, okay, I feel this because of that. And then I feel this because of that, and try to understanding the layers. Just allow yourself to feel it. If you're feeling angry, depressed, whatever the heck it is, just understand, say, okay, this is what I'm feeling. And then sit there and literally just feel that emotion without attaching a story to it, and just allow it to pass through. And I think that a physical, biological approach of just letting it be a sensation and letting it pass after a few minutes or however long it takes, and constantly doing that. To me, I like that approach of just not, it takes a little bit of the pressure off of trying to be a psychiatrist to yourself.
And
understanding why this is, because yes, of course it could be obviously because of my dad, or obviously because I lost my job, whatever the heck it is. But just letting that feeling go through, I think, is a process that I've really liked. And also I talked to Phil Cohen many years ago, who was a TED Talk speaker, and he gave a cool analogy that was, you ever look at those big multicolored beach balls? Like, you ever try to push it underwater? And it's just, it's hard to keep underwater. But once you're forcing yourself to hold that beach ball down, the deeper you push it down, it gets harder to control. And eventually, if you let go, it's just going to burst through the air and pop up over the water. That was a good approach of him saying, yes, you can't keep pushing shit down. You can't, because eventually that beach ball is going to pop right past you. It's going to be harder and harder to control. So you're constantly navigating through life, trying to keep this beach ball underwater when it's not supposed to be under there. It floats for a reason. So it's like, that approach and those words really stuck to me. What Phil said is, because that is what we're constantly doing. And I'm not generalizing it, but I feel like we're constantly trying to bury this beach ball, as instead of allowing the beach ball to go where it's supposed to be, and allowing yourself to feel it as opposed to doing it. Because we feel like I feel like sometimes by pushing things aside and doing this, it's actually helping us, but no, it's not. It's like, it's another thing to worry about. It's another thing to constantly work on pushing away, when you can just go through the storm as opposed to going around it, under it, over it, and get through it. And it's harder to do. We think by pushing these things aside that we're doing us a favor, but we're just constantly just making it worse. And so those are a couple things that just stand out off the cuff.
Well, I love those. I love those, because those are the learnings that you took that have meaning for you. And I think that's good conversation, leaves an imprint on us.
But one thing I did disagree, sorry to cut you off there, is I had Neil deGrasse Tyson on the podcast, who's coming from a very scientific approach.
Yeah.
And again, he's much smarter than me in many ways, in regards to especially the scientific realm and how all that works. But when he explains his beliefs and what happens in the afterlife and XYZ, he's taking it from a very show me kind of thing, which I totally understand. I think that's where a lot of people stand. If they can't understand the evidence or show me why this is, then it doesn't have any scientific backing. So therefore it doesn't exist, from what he understands. I just have a different approach in life. Again, less educated in that world, but just, I think there are things you cannot see. And by just understanding science in general, in the quantum field, this all works by the invisible. Everything is operating by the invisible. So to me, by theory, I'm like, maybe it's possible there's a whole other realm that we can't see or understand. And he doesn't see it like that, which is fine. He's coming from a totally different background, but I just disagree in his thinking of saying, he said something along the lines of, can you remember where you were before you were born? He's like, exactly. So therefore it's the same thing when we go after, we're just stardust and we continue, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, science is constantly learning. With many things have been debunked after one theory seems to be a statue that we've been living on forever. And then it just completely gets flipped on its script. So I understand where he's coming from, but I disagree, because I totally think there's more after this, even though he's coming from a very evidence-based approach. So it's as interesting and as real as his approach is, but just because you don't know it now doesn't mean it's not real.
Well, it's two different ways of thinking. You're making me think about, my grandmother was incredibly Catholic, and I don't know, when I was in college or high school, the Shroud of Turin is the piece of fabric that they wiped Jesus's face with when he was carrying the cross, and it's kept in Turin, and it was missing for a while, but by folklore, it has a stain that's supposed to look like Jesus's face on it. And for whatever reason, they decided to carbon date the fabric when I was in high school or college. And it came back, and lo and behold, this piece of fabric couldn't possibly be as old as the story of Jesus and when he carried the cross. And I remember being like, Gran, what do you think of this? It turns out the Shroud of Turin is a lie. And my grandmother said, if Jesus wanted to prove himself to you, he would have done that ages ago, but that would require no faith. And the whole purpose of believing in something and having it be hard and healing is to develop your faith. And I just remember being like, oh man, that old lady just shut me down in this. And really then being like, I like her way better. I like her way better. That in her mind, why would any God allow you to carbon date anything if really what they're trying? Of course it would come back. Because if it was proof, then it wouldn't be hard to believe in. And in order, you need it, faith is something that's challenging to believe in. And maybe also science is. Maybe also it's difficult to understand science.
Yeah,
but
it's
I like the idea.
Sides to that.
What'd you say?
I was saying there's two sides to that. It's like I the lesson approach, that I don't want to call it idealistic, but like that faith-based approach, the lesson inherently to me is, it's amazing. So I think that's a big part of getting through life. Then you'd be like, but like, the evidence shows that it's literally
not. And that's where you're stuck, right? Yeah. That's where you're stuck. So you and Neil would go around in a circle, or someone who didn't want it to all have to make scientific sense. And one thing that I, when my mom died, I didn't really love when people would say to me like, oh, but she's still here, or there's signs, or there, I found that kind of like minimizing in terms of my pain. I just was doing the pain thing. I didn't need to feel better about it. And now I do feel like there's energy out there that feels like, how could this not be connected to something that is, if not her, something energetically bigger than me, right? I can't go outside and make a tree. I don't know what makes trees. It might just be the earth and science, but it could also be something larger than that. And now that the pain of my mother's death has dropped out a little bit, I do have room for all these other like squirmy kind of questions about what is the meaning and what do I think happens and how, and I have none of it figured out, by the way, 0%, but I have tolerance for people talking to me about it now in a way that I didn't way back when.
Yeah, no, I get it. Especially when I've had several near death experiences on my story. So at the minimum, it makes me question things. Like I have my thoughts and my beliefs, but it opens the door for contemplation.
Again, I love those episodes. I love that you have a medium. I think it's a medium or a psychic on your show. And again, you definitely let them know you've got some skepticism. You're like, I don't know, I'm not sure, which I love. Yeah. Again, it's really ever present with your humor. What's next for you? Do you know what you're doing? Dead Talks is huge and big, and we're going to keep seeing that. Are you adding to that? Are you taking speaking engagements? Can people see you live places if they want you to come ask them questions? Can they meet you in a city and you'll come up to them with a microphone? What's up for your next steps?
Yeah. So a lot of it is just goals that I'm setting forth. I hope people would want to see me talk. That's a big mission for this year, is just carve out a positive message or a story or whatnot that I can really hopefully approach people and they'll find value. So speaking engagements are in the future, looking to get those opportunities and take baby steps. As we discussed, the street talks, I definitely feel like doing events is something that is a big part of what I want to do. I want to create these live events that is more of a grief panel or just death discussion, but also mix in stand-up comedy and music in a way more upbeat kind of vibe, where it's hopefully more fun and interactive and gets your brain and emotions working, but also can laugh. So I think I really have these ideas of these events that I want to put on in the future, obviously mixed in with speaking engagements, but highlighting people that are speaking outside of me. There's a lot down the line that I feel like growing this podcast, this brand of Dead Talks, as opposed to just the podcast is the main vein. But I have had my eyes set on some much bigger things. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm just trying to grow it and try to take
next
life.
Right thing.
Take life.
Next right thing.
I mean? Yeah.
All right. Before I let you go, and I'm going to let you go, I really like to ask this question to people because I think of it as like putting things on a menu. Do you remember as a kid or now anything specific that a friend or a family member did for you in your grief that felt really supportive? So it could be something that people do now when you're grieving or way back then, but just, I love to give people who are like, God, I'm really trying to support a griever, just a concrete example of something that somebody who went through a profound loss said helped.
Something, this might not help other people, but in regards to going forward than backward, I learned with my mother that sometime after this all happened, I found out many years later that when I would leave the house, I would go downstairs, check on my mom, tell her I'm leaving the house. And she was just like, yep, all right, have fun, do this, do that. And then I found out after having a heart to heart with my mom, saying that she finally opened up to me, said, yeah, when you would leave the house and I'll be by myself, that's when I would cry. That's when I would let it all out. I just never did it in front of you. Even though I saw her cry, of course, plenty of times, but she would have these moments where she'd let it out alone and keep that stern, strong look for us, because that was her, we were her why. And to me, that made me sad, but it just made me understand the sacrifice that she made for me. So I think in regards to being there for other people, I think if you have an opportunity to sacrifice for the other person, I think there's something there. I can't tell you what that sacrifice is. I think that's something between you and the person and trying to understand what they need, or by asking what they need. But I think once in a while, a little sacrifice for another person goes a long way, even if they don't see it. That's the thing. It's like the Batman approach of living long enough to be the hero or the villain. There's so many things that I'm making a Batman approach right now. This is crazy. Like the way Batman would work is he'd do things behind the scenes that people don't see. We're not, even though we feed a homeless person the meal, we don't have to film it and show it on Instagram. There's some things that you do behind the scenes, put your pride aside, and you can do things they may not notice. You know what I mean? Like it's like a simple example of paying someone's meter when it's on red. That person will never know you put a quarter in for them, but now they don't have a ticket and they might never know it to do it, but that's a sacrifice. It's these little sacrifices I think we can make for people that are seen or not seen. Just do it.
In therapy, we call that like a doorknob, where somebody gives you like something really important right at the last minute and you can't, you're like, oh my God, we have to wait till next session to talk about that. But that, David, that just gave me so many chills, because the word sacrifice is not a word that I have used before. And I'm going to hold on to this, because when I am talking to people who are trying to support grievers, what I often talk about is you have to hold your own need to be important, need to be validated, need to be seen, need to be whatever. Your griever's needs have to be the entire sun right now. And if you can't do that, then you need to step back. If you need them to thank you, if you need them to care that you did it. After my mom died and I did a stint in inpatient, probably like 2 years later, I heard my husband and my sister talking, and I was like, what are you guys talking about? And he was like, when she came to visit. And I was like, when are you talking about? And then they were like, oh, when you were in treatment and she came to help take care of the kids. And I was like, it was 2 years later. Wow. I wept about that all night. No one told me. She didn't want any credit for it. Maybe the kids mentioned it, but I didn't know anything about it. And then I was like, what else did you do? And I learned like she sent my kids Legos, that she called them every day. My husband wasn't left to parent without me there, but also nobody asked me to care about that. They just asked me to do my grief and to get well and gave me the space to do that. And that what it was. An incredible sacrifice. Amazing. That my sister made. And there was no glory. Yeah. It was just a gift. So we are wrapping up the end with a very, what feels to me like holy truth that you just told us, that sacrificing something for someone who needs it from you is just an incredible way to show up for a griever. I totally agree. Thank you for that. That was gorgeous.
Thank you.
You did it. You rang the bell. That's it. Favorite guest ever.
Get out of here.
I can't wait to talk to you again. Thank you so much for doing this.